Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Lynn Wilson is joined by Dr. Deepak Narayan. Dr. Narayan is Associate Professor of Plastic Surgery and Chief of Plastic Surgery at the West Haven VA. Here's Lynn Wilson.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do.
I've been trained both in general surgery and plastic surgery, and part of what I do is a combination of treatment for melanomas from a surgical standpoint, as well as the reconstruction of the defect that it entails. Now, melanomas are my primary interest, but I also deal with other types of cancers and reconstructions principally, and these include breast cancers and head and neck cancers.
Tell us a little bit about your background, your training, and how did you become interested in this field?
So I started off training as a general surgeon, and I'm board certified in general surgery. And during this time, I became interested in surgical oncology, spent a three-year research fellowship at Yale doing research in surgical oncology. But I found that the more difficult aspects of treatment were the reconstruction of the defects that resulted from surgical resections, which is why I moved into the reconstructive aspects of oncologic surgery. So what I do principally now revolves around melanoma treatment, both as a primary caregiver from the surgical standpoint and the reconstruction, as well as reconstruction for other cancers, which I don't get involved with from the resection standpoint, such as breast tumors or head and neck cancers.
Now, you obviously deal with lots of different cancer types. Can you tell us a little bit about how they differ in terms of plastic surgical needs, treatment modalities?
Right. So every area has a unique requirement in terms of what the plastic surgeon can provide. For instance, if we were to take a squamous cell cancer of the head and neck areas that involves the jawbone, for instance, reconstruction for that particular patient involves a multiplicity of aims, including restoration of the contour of the jawbone, the ability to chew, the prevention of drooling, as well as the necessity to provide dental implants. So, for instance, in that case, we'd involve that would involve removing a bone from the leg, anastomosing, meaning hooking up the blood vessels from the leg using a microscope into blood vessels of the neck, thereby restoring contour, providing cosmesis, providing a firm basis for the dental implants to be placed, chewing and restoring speech. On the other hand, a patient, a woman with breast cancer, for instance, has her femininity issues to be concerned about, as well as how she perceives herself as a woman. And so reconstruction from this standpoint would involve mostly restoration of the breast contour and more address the psychic aspects of the surgical resection involved.
And so to be able to do all of these different types of reconstructions, you mentioned 3 years of research and clinical work in your fellowship in addition to the general surgery, but this just must take an incredible amount of experience and training to be able to do all of these different things.
Right, I think that's absolutely accurate. So when I look back and count the number of years it took to finally get out of the other side, it comes to a total of about 17 years. I did spend some time at Memorial Sloan Kettering working with excellent surgeons there who taught me a lot about reconstruction, and owing to the high volume, we're able to see a lot in a very little time. Plastic surgery residency now takes a minimum of 3 years from the plastic standpoint, and when I did the training, it involved 5 years of general surgery and then 3 years of plastic surgery. Nowadays, it's been condensed a little bit, and you can sort of finish in about 6 years, and that leaves you enough time to do a fellowship. But coming back to your original question, I think it does take a lot of training to be able to reconstruct various areas satisfactorily.
So today we're going to focus specifically on melanoma. And can you tell us what are some of the risk factors for developing melanoma? How can it be prevented?
So while not much is known exactly about how melanoma is caused, I think the risk factors have been very clearly delineated. The most important one, obviously, is exposure to the sun. And it's been shown that early sun exposure in childhood, especially involving sunburns, can be potent risk factors for developing melanoma at a later age. The obvious answer in terms of prevention is to use adequate amounts of sunscreen, and what's recommended by dermatologists in the field is something above an SPF of 35. The point about all this is that you have to reapply it fairly frequently, especially if you're close to the water or in the swimming pool or the beach, and I think that's where most people neglect to carry on these preventive measures. Genetic factors play an important role, and I think that's beginning to be pretty obvious to people doing research in the field. Not much is known about the genetic predisposition, and these families who have a predilection for melanomas are very rare in terms of having their propensity to develop melanomas identified. People who are immune suppressed also seem to have a slightly higher incidence of melanomas, and a special population is the HIV-infected population, though we don't see it as much as, say, squamous cell cancer or other cancers in this group. A very rare syndrome is the so-called xeroderma pigmentosum, where essentially you get what's called sun poisoning, and the cells are not able to repair the damage caused by UV light, and that seems to be the causative factor for the development of melanomas.
And along the lines of genetics, folks with lighter skin, red hair, blue eyes, do they tend to have some increased risk?
You're absolutely right. I think the Celtic population and people who sunburn easily, the so-called Fitzpatrick type 1 skins, people who rarely tan but very frequently burn, are very likely to have melanomas. And this usually speaks to an Irish or a Scottish ancestry.
Now, do we get the sense that melanoma is more common now than, say, 30 years ago?
That's an interesting question. If you look at the numbers alone, that would be most certainly the case, because melanoma appears to be one of the most rapidly increasing cancers in the United States today. The numbers seem to be dropping off slightly in the last couple of years. Part of it may be due to the fact that the population in general is much more aware of what these issues are, and dermatologists have been repeatedly told how important it is to pick these cases up early, and therefore what we might be seeing is a situation where people are much more aware of problems and therefore are much more likely to bring it to light. So it's not entirely clear to everyone that this is indeed an increasing incidence as opposed to an increasing detection rate that we're seeing.
I see, and that would obviously be a good thing if we're doing a better
Absolutely.
Job at detection.
There's no question about it.
Because obviously, naturally, we might think that the incidence might be going down because of the use of sunscreen, say, for example, over the past 30 years.
Correct. And I think sunscreens have proven to be a bit of an issue as well, because most people think of sunscreens as something magical, applied once and then you're safe for the whole day. And some studies have suggested that people who use sunscreen actually may have a slightly higher incidence of melanomas only because they don't reapply it and they are willing to get sunburned under the misguided notion that if you apply the sunscreen once, you're good for the whole day. And that might actually be a paradoxical finding.
Yeah, and obviously not the case.
No.
What are some of the treatment options for, obviously, early stage melanoma? It sounds like the primary treatment is a surgical approach. But talk us through the different degrees of stages of melanoma, so to speak, and some of the different treatment options that are considered.
Sure. So as you point out, surgical treatment still is a mainstay for most melanomas that we see. So melanomas that are in the early stages, for instance, that are limited to the skin itself and have not spread elsewhere are easily treated by surgery alone. Some of the tests that are done as a part of the workup for melanomas involves assessing whether the melanoma has spread to the lymph nodes or not. And this appears to be the most common site of spread. And in those cases, we perform a procedure called a sentinel node biopsy, which involves specifically sampling a certain node in a lymph node or a lymph gland in the draining lymph nodal area. This may be under the armpit, in the neck, in the groin, depending on where your melanoma is. And based upon what the pathologist tells us, meaning whether there is a melanoma cell present in the lymph node or not, we go ahead and dissect out the remaining lymph nodes, the logic being that if one of them has melanoma cells in it, there may be others that have it, and removing them might help survival. As we go further along the spectrum, the treatment options get a little less effective. For instance, if you had brain metastasis as a consequence of melanomas, some of these lesions, these areas can be resected, but that's very unusual. And most of the time what's done is offer the patient localized radiation treatment, which can be very effective in treating small numbers of metastasis to the brain. Other options are dependent upon the type of metastasis you see. For instance, if you had a melanoma in the leg that had spread to various parts of the leg, one of the treatment options would be to offer what's called an isolated lymph perfusion. And essentially what that involves is to identify the main blood vessel of the leg and perfuse it, meaning pass a fluid containing very high doses of chemotherapy through the leg locally so that it doesn't have any systemic effects. In effect, putting the leg on bypass, much as the heart surgeons do, so that very high doses of chemotherapy can be delivered directly to that site. Other options that are available for an increasingly aging population are, for instance, BCG injections, or more recently, Aldera, which is a form of an immune stimulant which can be applied directly to the lesions and sometimes produces spectacular results.
In terms of the surgical resection, what is the current thinking in terms of how wide margins should be? In other words, how big is big enough?
Right. So in the earlier part of the last century, it was thought that bigger was better, and people resected fairly large mutilating chunks of tissue around the melanoma in the hope that it would cure them. It's been found, as with other types of cancers, that you really don't need to resect such large amounts of tissue. And in general, the guidelines for resection of melanomas is based upon the thickness of what the original melanoma was. For instance, if the melanoma was a millimeter in thickness, about a centimeter margin around it will suffice. If, for instance, it was 2 millimeters thick, a 2 centimeter margin would work perfectly well. In fact, for any thickness beyond 2 to 3 millimeters, more than a 2 centimeter margin has not been shown to improve the results of local control. And so most surgeons now would limit themselves to resecting that amount.
So typically when the lesion is early, small, that can be resected and with a pretty straightforward surgical closure.
Absolutely.
And may not require a plastics procedure, so to speak.
Correct.
I see. And can this type of operation be done by a variety of different kinds of surgeons?
Yes, in fact, it is. For instance, the earlier forms of melanomas, very early stages, the melanomas in situ, for instance, can be easily resected by the dermatologic surgeons with equally good results as, say, for instance, a plastic surgeon would produce. General surgeons, depending upon where you are in the country, are also equally capable of doing it. I think the issues come in, for instance, when these involve cosmetically sensitive areas, such as the face, the nose, the ear, and so forth, or functionally important areas such as the hand, where resections of this kind can produce significant problems if they aren't treated in a proper manner.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about plastic surgery for melanoma with Dr. Deepak Narayan.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer, and in Connecticut alone, there will be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery at Yale Cancer Center is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Deepak Narayan, and we're discussing plastic surgery for melanoma. Deepak, we talked about some of the considerations in terms of how extensive a surgical procedure might have to be. The good news is that for smaller early lesions, it does not have to be particularly extensive. For things that might be more complicated, who do you think is a especially good candidate for plastic surgical treatment for melanoma? And what are some of the common areas that are seen? I know you mentioned the nose, the ear, the hand, but are there certain situations when you learn of a patient with melanoma, and in that situation, it's almost crystal clear to you that this person's probably going to benefit from at least your involvement from the plastic surgical standpoint?
Right. I think what's changed in the recent years is the expectation of the public in terms of the results that are obtained. And when people talk of plastic surgery, they usually associate it with cosmetic surgery. And the truth of the matter is most plastic surgeons do a lot of reconstructive surgery as well. And defining exactly the difference between reconstructive and cosmetic surgery is a sort of a gray area. It's very clear then if something is cosmetically sensitive, such as the nose, the eyelids, the ears, or the mouth, or has significant functional consequences as a result of the removal, it would necessarily benefit from the involvement of a plastic surgeon. Now, it also depends a great deal upon the patient. For instance, if there was a lesion, a melanoma on the back that needed to be removed by a general surgeon who offered the patient an option of a skin graft, in theory, that would be a perfectly adequate treatment for it, but the patient might not feel happy having skin taken from elsewhere, placed on the back, and the resulting defect that would ensue. And therefore, those might be instances where a plastic surgeon could get involved in order not to use a skin graft, but to use a local flap in order to reconstruct that defect and produce the best results possible. As I mentioned earlier, for instance, the fingers, the hands, or lesions involving or melanomas close to major nerves are probably best dealt with a surgeon who's experienced in dealing with these kinds of issues rather than the occasional operator who might end up causing more damage treating it rather than someone who's more experienced in the field.
So you mentioned two things, a skin graft and a flap. Could you go into a little bit more detail for our audience about what those things are? What are the differences?
Right. So, for instance, if you can imagine a defect the size of, say, a golf ball on top of your thigh as a consequence of removing a melanoma. Now, that could easily be treated by taking skin from elsewhere, which is what a skin graft is, where you remove a layer of skin, much as you would take a layer of skin or a layer of, say, for instance, cheese using a cheese spatter and place it upon the defect and stitch it in place. The problem with that kind of an approach is that the skin is usually removed from a different area and does not match the color and the texture to the donor area that it's being applied to. Also, it doesn't have the same thickness. And so while you might get a closed wound, which has healed well, you obviously can see that the skin in that area is different from the skin surrounding it and doesn't quite have the same contour as the surrounding tissue. A flap, on the other hand, utilizes tissue that's adjacent to the defect And using well-known surgical principles, you can actually transfer this much as you would, I suppose, in a case of surgical origami, move it into place and suture it down so that you get the best possible results because you're using the same skin, the same texture, you're restoring the contour, and while you may have a few extra scars in that area, they usually are planned in such a way as to minimize the cosmetic effect.
In your practice, Deepak, have you found the need or the occasion to use artificial devices as part of reconstruction, parts from cadavers or non-related donors, for example?
I have, and these are very special situations. We are faced with an increasingly elderly population, and one of the problems of melanomas in these individuals is that it occurs on a fairly large field, if you will, of change from sun exposure. As a consequence, it becomes very difficult to distinguish cells that are overtly malignant versus those that are damaged by the sun. And under those circumstances, it's best to have the pathologist look at these cells very carefully. So rather than go and remove the tumor and then close it at the same sitting, we may actually benefit from the use of these adjuncts that you mentioned, which is artificial skin or skin substitutes, to cover the wound until such time the pathologist is able to tell us, yes, the margins are clean, you can go ahead and close the wound without the fear of having to go back in again and remove the flap or the skin graft that you've so carefully placed.
I see. Let's talk a little bit now about the actual melanoma program at Yale. Tell us a bit about that, its background, and your role within that program.
So the Yale Melanoma Program was founded approximately 30 years ago by Dr. Steve Arian, who was a former chairman in the Department of Surgery in the Section of Plastic Surgery. Since then, it has grown by leaps and bounds. And for instance, at our last melanoma meeting, we had almost 40 people in the audience. Now, part of this has been Dr. Arian's philosophy to be all-inclusive, mostly to get people who are directly involved in patient care. While it might not be obvious to the lay public, we have people who are involved in genetics, social workers, psychologists, in addition to who you'd traditionally associate with multidisciplinary cancer programs, such as medical oncologists, radiation therapists, surgeons, and so forth. Dr. Arian and I are the principal surgical oncologists in the Yale Melanoma Program, and we see a large number of melanomas in Connecticut at the Yale Melanoma Program itself. And part of the reason the Yale Melanoma Program has gone from strength to strength is that we also have a very strong research basis and background to what we do. We've recently been awarded a major grant from the National Institute of Health, headed by Dr. Ruth Haliban. We have a medical oncologist, Dr. Schnoll and Dr. Harry Kluger, who are pioneering new medical treatments for advanced melanoma, which obviously keeps us at the cutting edge of this research. You have input from different minds who see the problem from different perspectives, and putting them all together obviously gives you the best result for the patient. Secondly, you're not allowed to force a point of view which may or may not be backed up by literature or research solely on the grounds that you are the treating physician, and therefore it becomes a much more democratic and ultimately a much better offering for the patient to have a multidisciplinary input. And I think this is the way most cancer treatments are evolving in the United States and indeed across the world today.
And is it more convenient for the patient? Does a patient come in and possibly see several specialists in one visit or at least part of that day as opposed to having to go to multiple doctor's offices over several weeks?
It's true, and that is a definite advantage. Part of it also depends upon the grade or the stage of melanoma that you're seeing the patient in. For instance, most of the patients that I see save themselves the trouble of seeing an oncologic surgeon as well as a reconstructive surgeon, so you essentially get two for the price of one. Along the same lines, for instance, if the medical oncologist had a patient who they were seeing for other metastatic problems, and they had some surgical issues that they wanted input on. It's very easy for us to walk across and see the patient and offer what surgical suggestions we might have. And so the bottom line is, I think having a multidisciplinary group, especially one that works as closely as we do in the Yale Melanoma Program, is a great benefit for all patients coming in to the Yale Cancer Center.
Well, that sounds terrific. What are some of the advances in your field, plastic surgery, over the past 5 to 10 years that you have incorporated into your practice to help these patients? And are there new techniques or things that are being developed that you think you'll utilize in the future?
So plastic surgery has a pretty long and ancient history. In fact, we do use techniques that were in use almost 2,000 years ago. So when you look at it from that perspective, new can mean a lot of different things. What we do see nowadays, for instance, you already mentioned, is the use of skin substitutes. And that has been particularly helpful in temporizing reconstructions for people who need a lot of or a large degree of surgical resection. Over the last 15 to 20 years, methods of tissue transfer improved significantly, and what we use are called free flaps, whereby you take tissue from other areas of the body, hook them up using a microscope to blood vessels in the area that's been treated in order to reconstruct the defect. Now, I must point out that this is unusual in melanomas, at least in Connecticut, because we see them pretty early, and those lesions requiring such a large resections are not very common. Something new that's on the horizon and has been on the horizon for some time is the role of artificial organs and recreating new tissue in the lab so you don't have to use the body as a source for reconstruction. So the concept of tissue engineering is gradually taking hold. And most of these advances, at least the ones that we use on a reasonably regular basis, involve fat transfer, because fat can be used to restore contour in a variety of situations.
And when you talk about tissue engineering, are we talking about cells from the patient who needs the surgery, or someone genetically similar to them, or someone completely unrelated? How does that work?
So the short answer is all of them. Ideally, we'd like to use the patient's cells alone for a variety of reasons. Number one, we don't have to worry about them being immunologically different from the patient's other cells. Secondly, the question of transmission of infectious diseases through cells obtained from other folks obviously doesn't exist, because you're using the patient's own tissue samples. Sometimes it may be that the patient is not able to produce the tissue that we need in question. Therefore, a combination of these methods can, and obviously in the future, will be used. I think most of what we use on a regular basis in terms of tissue engineering usually results from skin substitutes or cells that approximate the skin. And this was originally started off in the treatment of burns at Yale many years ago, and now has sort of reached the mainstream.
Very quickly, what is the process like for a patient who undergoes a reconstructive surgery? Generally, I know it depends obviously on what part of the body and how extensive, but how long is the hospital stay, and what sort of follow-up program do they need?
So most of the patients who undergo reconstructive surgery have a one-day procedure. They come in, get the surgery done, they're treated adequately for the pain, and they go home the same day. It's very rare that we admit the patients overnight, and some of those patients might be those who need lymph node dissections or something a little more involved, such as the isolated lymph perfusions. But these are the rarity when you compare the whole spectrum of melanoma patients that we treat. So once they're sent home, they're usually asked to come back within a week to 10 days to check their wounds, remove their sutures and such. And depending upon the stage of the melanoma, we have them come back to see us at least twice a year for about 5 years, which is the generally accepted guidelines for follow-up for melanomas.
Dr. Deepak Narayan is Associate Professor of Plastic Surgery and Chief of Plastic Surgery at the West Haven VA. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.